You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
The son of former Major League Baseball player and manager Jim Lefevre, Ryan Lefevre, has been around baseball for nearly his entire life. His dad's tenure playing for the Los Angeles Dodgers ended when Ryan was nearly 2 years old, but he spent the next four summers in Japan while his dad played for the Lotte Orions. Learned how to say that tonight. Ryan was an outfielder who played college baseball for the University of Minnesota, where he was named first team All Big Ten in 1991 and 93, and was named the MVP of the Gophers in 1993. He spent one season in the Cleveland Indians minor league system. Started his broadcasting career in 1995 with the Minnesota Twins, spent the next 4 years there, and he was hired by the Kansas City Royals prior to the 1999 season. And he's now in his 23rd season as the primary television voice of the team. Rhino, welcome to Sports Connections.
Thank you, David. Good to see you.
Does it seem like you could possibly be in your 23rd season with the Royals?
No, I still think I'm 23 years old, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just kind of shaking my head when you said that. I mean, I know that's a fact, but the circumstances of my arrival back in 99, I mean, I had no roots in Kansas City. I mean, I was the new guy in town, the unpopular new guy in town. And I don't know if I've ever really completely gotten over that. I still kind of feel like the new guy in town.
Yeah, certainly you filled some big shoes, and I want to talk about that here in just a little bit. But you've been able to help other guys who've come in as the new guy by probably relating some of your own experiences in that. The team has had plenty of lows in your 22 years, but two very high highs. How much fun was it to be so intricately involved in the success of the team in 2014 and 2015?
Well, it's really hard to put into words, because I had never done a playoff game before 2014. Here's a little fact for you, David. Going into 14, let's see, I'm going to have to say this slowly. Going into 14, I was the longest current tenured major league broadcaster who had never done a playoff game. So, I mean, if you went and you looked at it, There were broadcasters who had been doing this longer than I had at that point, but they had at least done a playoff game. I was the longest current tenured Major League Baseball broadcaster who had not done a playoff game. So, I really didn't know what to expect. The joy was obvious. I mean, just especially 14, it was just so unexpected, and we blinked our eyes and we're in Game 7 of the World Series. And I remember the beginning of the World Series, because it just went by so fast, and it was so unexpected. I remember literally sitting in the radio booth, looking down at the field, and you know, they have the painted logos near the coaches' boxes on both sides. And I remember staring at those logos going, this is the real World Series. I mean, like, this isn't the practice World Series before, you know, the Yankees and the Dodgers show up. I mean, this is the real World Series. It was amazing, but I learned a very valuable lesson after the wild card game. You know, I started at a very young age. I was 24, and my ego was not in the right place at the time. And I got into broadcasting partly for good reasons and partly for not good reasons. And so I was envious of a lot of major league broadcasters who had these iconic calls.
Yeah.
You know, we'd go to all these different stadiums. I mean, just like Kauffman Stadium, if you get there early enough, at some point there will be a highlight film of the greatest moments in the team's history. And these go on in every stadium across the country. And there's always just these great calls. And a lot of times that broadcaster was still with the team. And I'd look down at the booth and think, man, how cool would that be if someone was playing your call night after night after night? And I began to realize, in order to have an iconic call, you have to have an iconic game. And I was not in any iconic games whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it was just about me and my career. And, you know, we weren't just bad during that stretch, David. As you know, we were historically bad. I mean, it was just awful. I saw that Bill Snyder has been one of your guests on your podcast. And, you know, the Royals, I think, after what he accomplished with K-State football, I mean, it was the same kind of hopeless situation, you know, with the Royals. And so we win that crazy wildcard game in 2014. And after doing the game on radio with Denny, I had to get out to right field and do post-game television for Fox Sports Kansas City. So I was in the radio booth not long after the game was over. And then I had to make my way. And I went through the concourse. And at that point, people were just starting to leave their seats and head to their cars. So they were going from their seats into the concourse. And I'd never seen anything like that before. I mean, people were beside themselves. They were so excited, and they were high-fiving each other and hugging each other. It was like that great cover on Life magazine during World War II, and that sailor is kissing that girl at Times Square, and we come to find out they didn't even know each other. They were just so excited, you know? Yeah. I mean, I'm just watching these complete strangers just screaming and yelling, and they're just, you know, overwhelmed with excitement because of that game, but also because it was over. That long playoff drought was over. We were no longer, you know, the punchline of every single baseball joke. And I went from feeling kind of like, hey, I'm a part of this big thing here, to just realizing I was a very small part of all of it. And I got a glimpse of how important this was to the fans and to the city. And then, of course, at the parade, seeing all those people cheering in downtown Kansas City, it was overwhelming, but it was good perspective that all this time I've been wanting to be part of this iconic game because it was all about me. And then I realized this is not about me at all. So very long answer to your short question. You know, I remember the games and the moments of the games and all that, but mostly for me in 14 and 15, it was behind the scenes type stuff that I remember the most.
It's interesting. I've been working on a book, and it's a long range process down the line. I want to talk to people who've done a variety of sports, and it's your top 10 events that you've been to in person. And so, because I want to do this, I've got my own list. Number one on the list was I was at the Pine Tar game, as you know. Number two on that list was the wild card game. Can you remember, I mean, not just from your broadcasting career, but, you know, you just turned 50. You've been around baseball a long time. Can you remember a more dramatic game than that wild card game in 2014?
No, I mean, there was game four in Houston, and in 15, there was that heart stopping ninth inning in game six of the ALCS against Toronto in 15, but none of that happens without the wild card game in 14. And, you know, even if they had lost that game, it was just such an accomplishment to get back to the postseason. Ned Yost used to always say that wasn't the playoffs. That's the wild card game. The playoffs started against the Angels that year. But for us, I mean, that was the World Series. I mean, we were just, it was so exciting. And then, you know, the game just went south. What I remember the most about that game, if you and I, you know, spent 20 minutes talking about that game, I'd remember certain moments. But the one that stands out the most was how Ned Yost used Yordano Ventura and how that backfired and put the Royals in a big hole. And I remember he got booed when he went out to the mound to take Ventura out and then bring in Kelvin Herrera. And everyone wondered, you know, why did he do that? And Brandon Moss hit, I think, his second home run of the game or something like that. It didn't look good for the Royals. Ned Yost got booed like I've never heard anybody get booed at Kauffman Stadium, whether it is an opposing player. Now, I didn't go to the home run derby during the All-Star game. I know Robinson Cano got it pretty good, but I remember thinking, can Dayton bring him back after this? I mean, it was just like the wrath that was just showered upon Ned Yost. Now, of course, we learned different parts of that story in the days and years to come after that. And Ron Gardenhier had just been fired by the Minnesota Twins. And people were texting me, you know, Ron Gardenhier, line one, you know, that I wondered if that was going to cost Ned his job. I mean, that's what I remember thinking, gosh, what a thrilling night turned sour. And that's what I remember about the game. And then of course they, you know, they win the game on Salvi's hit, but, and that just, I mean, that just launched everything. I mean, the Royals won 8 games in a row in the postseason that had never been done before.
Right.
Take it all the way to a game 7. And I think that wild card game set the stage for the comeback in Houston the next year, because absolutely, they've been down, that group had been down before, you know, yeah. And both games they were down by 4 in the 8th inning, and they came back and won both games. So that, I mean, without that wild card game, the scary thing to think about it too, David, if they lost that game, and if they lost in the first round in 15, instead of back-to-back World Series and a championship, those 2 years could have been a wild card game and one round of the playoffs, and that was it. But that's what that team was all about, all those great comebacks.
The two things that stick in my mind, one, the conversation in the press box that Ned Yost may become the first manager to get manager of the year and get fired and deserve both. That was just kind of the thing going around there. The other thing I remember is that most of us in the press box, of course, in the radio booth, you can get excited. In the press box, we're not allowed to get excited. Probably most of the people in that press box should have had their credential taken away, because we were going absolutely nuts. Fortunately, the windows were up and nobody could hear us because it was so loud. But we're like, ah, oh, wait a minute, can't do that. But that's what I remember about that game. You mentioned that it just came out of nowhere, especially 14. I remember being in the, and I think it was either before game 1 of the World Series or before game 7, being in the dugout during the pregame stuff. And that was just really cool to be down on the field for the pregame stuff and see all these dignitaries. But I remember talking to somebody, and I don't remember if you were there at that particular conversation, but some of us who've been around the Royals for a while, saying, in your wildest imagination, did you ever think we'd be here in this situation? And it was almost unanimous. No. Flanny was there. I can't remember who else was there, but it was like, no, we never thought this would be possible. By 15, we're like, okay, yeah, we got a good team. We belong here. But in 14, it was just, I mean, it was like reaching, oh, we'll be in the World Series, pulling it out of thin air.
Well, I remember driving to the game before game 7, and I was listening to Kevin Keatsman on 810. And, you know, he's a Kansas Cityan and a veteran, sports journalist in Kansas City. And I remember he said, this is the biggest night in Kansas City sports history. And I remember thinking, wow, I mean, now we could debate as to whether, you know, he was correct or not. But then I started to think about it. I mean, what was the last time that this happened? Well, it was 85, but and the Royals had not won a World Series, but they were good for a long time.
Right.
And I think most people believed, I mean, that they were going to win a World Series eventually. And as it turned out, there was very little drama in game 7. And I think his point was that this was so much more unlikely that we would come from so low to game 7 of the World Series. And that, I remember that just stunned me. And I mean, I knew it was a big deal, don't get me wrong, but when you start talking about the greatest moment in the history of a city, when it comes to sports, that was quite a statement.
One of my favorite memories with you, when you and I first became friends in the summer of 1999, we had known each other a little bit. I walked up to you and I said, hey, next time you see your dad, tell him I said, thanks. And you said, okay, for what? And I said, well, he taught me how to read. And you said, that's kind of funny. He didn't teach me how to read. That was my mom. And you asked me to explain. I said, well, I learned by reading the back of baseball cards, and I got stuck on Lefebvre. And you said, tell me about it. I was in third grade before I could spell it correctly.
Yeah.
And we laughed about that a little bit. And then about 2 weeks later, you just walked up to me. We were watching batting practice. You walked up and you said, oh, Dad says you're welcome. talk about growing up in a baseball family.
Yeah, that's a complicated answer. I mean, as a young boy, it was very exciting. I mean, I this was back when, I mean, little kids could be bat boys and be on the field during batting practice. I remember when my dad was with the Dodgers as a coach in 78, 79. And so, you know, I'm 7 or 8 years old and I've got my little Dodger uniform with my name on the back, and I could hang out during batting practice. I could hang out in the clubhouse, and a bunch of us kids, the late Don Sutton's son, Darren, and I, and Daniel Say, Ron Say's son, and Manny Mota's kids, one of whom is Jose Mota, longtime broadcaster of the Angels. Mike Monday, Rick Monday's son. I mean, I remember all the names. We just played tape ball during the game. You know, I mean, everyone's like, wow, you got to go to all those games. That must have been great. I said, are you kidding me? We were raiding the snack room and stealing candy bars and playing tape ball in the tunnels of Dodger Stadium when we were kids.
Yeah.
And that carried over when my dad went to the Giants and I was a bat boy. And when Jerry Royce threw a no hitter against the Giants at Candlestick Park and the Dodgers and Giants, I mean, it was just a heated rivalry, way more than it is now. I mean, there were fights in the stands and someone would run on the field and someone would light a Dodger pennant on fire. I mean, I was like a 9-year-old kid taking this all in. Meanwhile, the team that my dad played for and coached for the year before is no hitting his team. I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, he went to the World Series in 88 as a coach with the Bash Brothers, the Oakland A's. I was a bat boy for that team. I mean, he was Ken Griffey Jr.'s first manager in 1989 in Seattle. I got to be part of that. You know, Omar Vizquel was a young player and Randy Johnson was just coming into his own. I mean, I've had a chance to experience a lot. So as a kid on the baseball side, it was a thrill. Personally, it wasn't so great. I mean, my parents divorced when I was very young. And, you know, I really didn't have a father growing up. I mean, I had a dad that I would see in the summer and over the holidays. But, you know, we didn't really have a father-son relationship where, you know, we'd go fishing and talk about girls and talk about life. I mean, he was more like an uncle to me than he was a father. And he was a great coach. I mean, I owe him a lot for my playing career just because of what I was exposed to. There are a lot of things I wasn't overwhelmed by in my college career because of what I was exposed to as a kid. And I think even into my broadcasting career, I owe that experience a lot because I've always been respectful and appreciate what players do and have done in this game, but I'm not in awe of them. I mean, I've always just known them as people. And so I think, you know, when I was 24 becoming a major league broadcaster, I mean, I had a lot to learn, but I knew how to handle myself in that environment. And so, yeah, there are a lot of layers to that question. And now being, you know, a father myself of four in this business, you know, I try and take the good that I remember from those days, but then there's a lot that I need to do that wasn't given to me when I was a kid in that environment.
It's interesting. My next question, you've kind of answered that. I'll just ask the question and you can see if there's anything else to add to that. We often hear about ball players having an advantage if their dads were players because they're used to being around the game and they're not intimidated by the game.
Right.
Do you think spending time around the game helped you as a broadcaster?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was 24, you know, I mean, you were saying, you know, I've been in the game, you know, most of my life. I remember at the end of last season, it hit me. I have been a major league broadcaster longer than I haven't been a major league broadcaster. I mean, and before that it was as, you know, tagging along with my dad, you know, as a bat boy and helping out in the clubhouse. And I would say my bat boy days came to an end when Ken Griffey Jr. was on that 89 team. And I figured if my dad's center fielder is 1 year older than I am, I'm not, my bat boy days are over.
Yeah.
And, you know, another great memory, I was in the dugout next to my dad when Griffey and Griffey had back-to-back singles against the Royals at the Kingdom. And I was sitting next to my dad in the dugout in Anaheim, because I'm from Southern California, when the Griffeys hit back-to-back home runs. In fact, if you watch that clip of the back-to-back home runs, I'm one of the knuckleheads giving them high fives when they come back to the dugout. But because of that, I mean, I knew how to conduct myself.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad told me at a really young age, you know, have fun, but stay out of everybody's way. These guys may be nice to you, but they have a job to do and you don't have a job to do here. So if guys are working, don't bother them. Stay out of their way. And I remember one thing he told me that I never forgot. He said, you know, if you're talking to a player and another player comes over or another coach comes over, you need to walk away. That's just not a conversation for you to listen to. And that served me well as a broadcaster, because I think I mean, I think like everybody else, David, I mean, I like, it's a compliment to me when I feel like I'm on the inside and I'm, and information is shared with me. That's not public information, but I tell you what, even to this day, I could be having a conversation with Dayton Moore on the field, and he and I have been together for a long time and have become friends. And if Ned Yost or Mike Matheny walks over, my first instinct is to get out of there. And sometimes, you know, Dayton or Ned or somebody might say, no, that's okay, you can stay here. You know, but I, it's still in me that I need to be out of there. Or if I'm talking to a player and another player comes over, a coach comes over. So, and there are some people who just don't have that court awareness, if you will, but that was just ingrained in me in a very young age. I just knew, I think I knew where I belonged and I knew where I didn't belong. And now I've been doing this for, you know, this will be 27 years if you count the Royals and the Twins, and there's still that part of me that feels like there are places that I don't belong.
You talked about being in the dugout next to your dad. One of my favorite memories, one of my favorite stories that you've told me is you were in the dugout when with the Bo Jackson play. Harold Reynolds playing for the Mariners was on first base, bottom of the 12th or 13th inning in Seattle. I was one of about eight people in Kansas City still watching the game because it was a Friday night. Right. And I can't remember who hit the ball, but Bo Jackson picked it up at the base of the wall as Reynolds in full stride, and he was a fast guy, as he touches third base and Bo threw a strike to home plate. And Bob Boone just, I mean, he deked Reynolds.
Yeah.
Caught the ball and reaches over and tags him. And your dad went out and argued the play. And you told me that when he came back, you said, what were you arguing? He was out by two steps. And you said something along the lines of, well, I went out to argue that Bo Jackson must not be human because that was not a human being play. So you wanted to pro. I don't remember the specifics, but just talk about your recollection of seeing that play.
Well, I mean, actually, I wasn't there. I came right after it happened.
Okay.
So, but I know all the specifics of the story. I mean, there was Scott Bradley was the one that hit the ball.
Okay.
And I heard, I mean, I might have gotten there the night after or two nights after, but to come visit him. But I mean, it had just happened. And I, all these stories about guys at the Kingdome, the clubhouse was, I mean, right behind the dugout. It, you know, even now in modern ballparks, it's still a pretty long walk up the tunnel from the dugout to the clubhouse. And it's a pretty long one at Kauffman Stadium, as you know, but in the Kingdome, I mean, it was right there. So guys would go in during the game and they'd get something to drink or get something to eat or go to the bathroom or whatever. And you could watch and listen to the game on TV while you were in there. And just all the stories about Scott Bradley hits the ball into the corner and they see Harold Reynolds coming around the bases, and they left the TV sets and ran to the dugout for a celebration. And it's like they ran into a library. It was so quiet because of the unexpected outcome. But when I got there, I did ask my dad, I said, well, you know, what were you arguing? It looked like he was out. And you know, there's actually a clip on YouTube. Joel Goldberg interviewed my dad when we were in Arizona several years ago for interleague play. He interviewed him during the game and he talked about that play. My dad, the joke now is he said, how can that, there's no way that guy could throw him out. But what my dad was arguing was, and I don't know the complete mechanics of umpires on a play like that, but something along the lines of, with a ball down into the corner like that, there's some sort of rotation where the third base umpire runs down into the corner to make sure it was fair or the ball doesn't get lodged under the wall or whatever. But he basically releases himself from third base and goes out there. The second base umpire, I think, stays home. The home plate umpire runs up the line and becomes the third base umpire. The first base umpire, since it's a sure double, as soon as the first base umpire sees the runner touch first base, he then runs home and he becomes the umpire, something like that. And if there's an umpire watching and I didn't get it right, you know, I apologize. But I do know the third base umpire, the home plate umpire, went to third. The first base umpire forgot to come home. So the call was made from a long distance at home plate. And I think it was the home plate umpire called him out, but he called it from third base because there was nobody there. So my dad, if you watch his antics, he points to third and then he points to home. And he's basically saying, how can you make that call from here? You know, you're out of position. So that's what he was arguing. But I mean, people were still talking about it days after I got there.
And the interesting, if people are watching something else while they're listening to this or they're watching this, pause it, go to Google, Bo Jackson, just Google Bo Jackson, Harold Reynolds, and you will see that just to me, still one of the most amazing baseball plays I've ever seen. So and I don't even remember who won the game. At that point, I was like, okay, this thing's never going to end. I think I went ahead and went to bed. Let me ask you this. You've obviously been in broadcasting for a long time now, more than half your life. When did you know that you wanted to get into broadcasting?
You know, it was in high school, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I wanted to play baseball. I mean, that's, you know, I was like every other kid, like, what do you mean I have to declare a major? I'm going to play baseball, you know? And I remember we were taking one of those Scantron tests in high school. It might've been like the PSAT or something like that. And my mom later in life, and when I say later in life, I mean, we're talking, you know, into her 30s, had gotten an audition at the ABC affiliate in Los Angeles. And she got to sit in the desk and read the news, the same desk with the same backdrop that we watched on TV every night, you know? And I mean, you know, at least for me, you know, the newscasters, they were like these mythical figures and doing the news from some mythical place, you know, and there's my mom reading the news and she brought the tape home and we watched it, you know, and I was like, wow. And she did a pretty good job. And something just must have clicked in my head, like, oh, I guess normal people can do jobs like that.
Yeah.
My mom was very into the news and very into politics and always had the news on and was always discussing politics with her friends. And so when I was trying to figure out a bubble to fill out on this Scantron, like, you know, what are you going to do? One of them said communications and it said radio/TV. And I thought, well, if my mom can get an audition as a newscaster, you know, maybe I could do that.
Yeah.
And my first determination was to be a newscaster. I there was like a stigma about, you know, the dumb jock that can do nothing but talk about sports. So he goes into sports. And I wanted to be Tom Brokaw. You know, Tom Brokaw started in Los Angeles when I was a kid and then he moved to New York and then, you know, ended up on the Today Show and then Nightly News and all that kind of stuff. And so I was going to be a newscaster. And so I went to college just saying, I'm going to get into broadcasting. And I, you know, but I wasn't one of these kids that listened to the radio all night, had all these stories about, you know, listening to Vince Scully all night and dreamed about being a broadcaster or studied the newscasters. I mean, I just decided that's what I'm going to do. And then I kind of just forgot about it. Well, my college coach at Minnesota, John Anderson, who's still there, he took it seriously. And he told my academic counselor that, you know, that's what I was going to major in. And every time somebody from radio, TV, or even print would come out and cover us, he would introduce me to them and say, this is Ryan Lefevre. He's from Los Angeles. He's our freshman center fielder, and he wants to get into broadcasting. So slowly I'm kind of making these networks. And I was really fortunate because at the University of Minnesota at the time, there were two stations on campus. There was a real station that you could hear driving around Minneapolis. And then there was the Animal House student station, you know, with a bunch of college kids pretending like they're broadcasters. And I got to work at both of them and very early into my college career. And I really began to like it. I went and played in the Cape Cod League two summers when I was in college. And my second summer there, I got an internship at a radio station on Cape Cod, which led to, honestly, David, me realizing that I was enjoying that more than I was enjoying playing baseball. I don't know if I ever loved playing baseball. I liked it. I liked being one of the better players. I was an only child until I was 13. So I liked being on a team. Yeah. But I remember that first summer in Cape Cod, which used to be in an elite college summer league. If you got invited to Cape Cod, I mean, you didn't have a choice. You had to go.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, you know, these guys care about this a lot more than I do. You know, I missed my buddies back in Minnesota. So it was during that time that I started to think about, you know, maybe I want to do something else with my life. And so I heard you say I played one season in the Cleveland Indians minor league system. That was actually 2 weeks in the Cleveland's minor league system because okay. I just knew you know, my heart wasn't in it anymore. And I had something else I was interested in. And so 2 weeks into it, I quit. I retired and I went back to Minnesota. Did a little bit of work when I got back there and worked at an all sports station, KFAN in Minneapolis. I worked at the all sports cable TV station, Midwest Sports Channel, which is now Fox Sports North. I worked at the CBS affiliate WCCO and just kind of was building my resume as an intern. But I can tell you my days as a television news anchor came to an end. I was interning at KFAN all sports radio station. And the program director at the time, his name was Mark Ginther, and he was young. I mean, he was, you know, maybe 30, but really smart. He came from a family of broadcasters, and he wanted to be a television news director someday. So he had these long-term goals. I had these long-term goals, but he was already the program director of the radio station. And he brought me in one day and he said, well, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a news anchor. And he said, well, you know, if you want to be a news anchor, you've got to be a news reporter first, right? Now, this was news to me, no pun intended, but I just, you know, I faked it. And I went, well, yeah, I know that. And it was like a scene out of a movie, David. I'll grab my glasses. He had, you know, he had his glasses on. He kind of looked down his glasses like this and he kind of straightened them. I said, he leaned across his desk and he said, okay, let's say two kids are playing on the Washington Avenue Bridge and they fall into the Mississippi River and they drown. Are you willing to take a camera crew to one of the kids' house and get a statement from their parents? I thought to myself, why would I ever want to do something like that? You know, I mean, I thought I was going to just throw up across his desk. And before I got up out of the chair and left his office, I realized I was never going to be a newscaster because that's just, I didn't have two things I realized really early in the process was I didn't have the breaking news DNA. I mean, there's people in our news who are just into that and bless them for it. You know, I mean, that's how we get breaking news. And we're all excited when we see breaking news. Me being the first one to get the story has just never been that important to me. Even to this day, I mean, I'll know that, you know, we've made a trade or we've signed a player or whatever before anyone else does. And it just, that's not what floats my boat. And I spent some time filling in as a talk show host. And I realized too, David, that I just didn't care enough about all of the sports to be a good talk show host. And I mean, I listen to guys in Kansas City now, and I mean, they go from this team and that sport to that team and this sport. And I just listen to them. I think, my gosh, how do they keep track of all that? So eventually I think just my personality just gravitated towards, you know, being a play-by-play announcer, but that's not what I set out to do at all.
It's interesting. You mentioned you didn't want to be the dumb jock. Nobody who knows you can accuse you of being the dumb jock. You were academic all Big Ten. How many years?
I was never academic all Big Ten, but unless that was awarded to me and I wasn't aware of it, but that would make me a dumb jock if I didn't know that.
Well, what I'm getting at, Rex and I have become pretty good friends. He says every day when he leaves for the stadium, Jennifer, his wife, says, Rex, just remember, you're not as smart as Ryan.
Oh, that's not true.
So anyway, a lot of that is just...
By the way, let me tell you something about Rex Hudler, okay? Rex, you know, looks at me as the college graduate and I'm the smart guy and he's the knucklehead baseball player. Do you know where Rex Hudler was going to go to college if he didn't sign with the New York Yankees?
Notre Dame.
So... just Royals fans, if Rex gives you the whole knucklehead routine, he was going to Notre Dame. So there.
I'm going to get into a little bit with Rex here in just a second here. But I want to talk about your style, because to me, I love listening to you. I love Denny too, but I love listening to you because I feel like I'm just listening to a friend in a casual conversation. Where did your broadcasting style come from?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the compliment. I mean, I think that's what I want people to hear. I mean, among other things, a great compliment that a broadcaster can get is, you know, if I'm in a store and having a conversation with somebody, you know, at the checkout counter, and they say, gosh, you sound the same in person as you do on the air. I mean, that's a compliment, because you and I know there are a lot of broadcasters that, as we like to say, they go into broadcaster mode, you know, their voice changes, their personality changes. And so, but it took me a while. I don't even really know what my style is, to be honest, because going back to 1995, when I was 24 years old, I was, you know, I was swimming with my nose just barely, you know, out of the water. I felt like just trying to pretend that I belong there. And what I would do my first year with the Twins, I was not in the booth very often. I had a role very similar to Joel Goldberg's. But my first year, I was not expected to do any reports during the game. That started in my second year. So what I would do is I would do my pregame show stuff, and then I would go and listen to the different announcers. I had 4 broadcast booths available to me every night. I had home radio, home TV, visiting radio, visiting TV. That's where it was at the Metrodome. And I would listen. I would go into the broadcast booth and I would listen and I would take notes and I would think, oh, I really like the way that, you know, he articulated that, or I like the way that he described that play, or, you know, I mean, I was just a sponge, just learning from so many different broadcasters. And as fate would have it, the very first broadcast booth I went into was Denny Matthews and Fred White in 1995. And that's when I met them for the first time. And most of the broadcasters were great. Come on in. Who are you? Nice to meet you. And so that served me well to learn how to be a broadcaster. I mean, I was kind of like, you know, we talk about a player that's still developing at the major league level. You know, I was a broadcaster still developing at the major league level. So, you know, but then for me to kind of to weed out in the end what wasn't me and what really was who I am, I think that was probably years into coming to Kansas City until I had a style where I felt like I didn't have to sound like somebody else, because I didn't have time to develop a style, but I do want it to sound like that. I'm having a conversation with somebody.
Okay. I want to talk about some of your partners. You've had some interesting partners. I don't remember who you were with necessarily with the Twins, but with the Royals, you've had Paul Splitter, Frank White, now Rex Hudler. Talk about some of your favorite memories with these men and anybody else you want to mention.
Yeah. And they're all so unique and so different. I'll begin with Split. I mean, Split played such a important role in my early years because, you know, I was not welcomed with open arms when I arrived in 1999 and I'm sitting in Fred White's chair and the fans didn't want me. They grew up with Fred and I understood that. And I knew it was going to be hard. I think it ended up being harder than I thought. Thankfully, Twitter wasn't around. Facebook wasn't around. The best somebody could do to, you know, make me feel like I was completely worthless was to call into a talk show or send a letter to the editor or just write me directly and tell me they thought I stunk, you know. But so it was difficult. But, you know, guys like, you know, Paul Splitorf in particular, because he and Fred White were very, very close. You know, he went out of his way to just check in on me every now and then. And we weren't working together at that time. I was doing radio only, but we traveled together and, you know, we spent a lot of time together at the ballpark and he was always, you know, checking in and making sure that I was all right. And I'll never forget that. And then I moved to television and he was my partner. And I'll be honest, David, I mean, probably the biggest reason why I agreed to the move from radio to television. I started doing some television by my 5th year. So let's see, that's 2003 I started doing some television. Then 2004 through 2007, I was doing anywhere from 25 to 40 games a year on television. Bob Davis would go over to radio. But then in 08, Fox got the rights back from RSTN. And I became the primary television announcer and Bob Davis went over to radio. And the biggest reason I went was I was thinking I was going to get to work with Paul Splitter for 20 years. I loved working with Split. And he was, he was the rare former player who became a broadcaster, a play-by-play broadcaster. And, you know, some people in the region who don't follow baseball know him as a great basketball analyst, you know, and didn't even know that he was the winningest pitcher in Royals history. But he was so humble. I mean, you needed a crowbar to pry out the information from his career. He just didn't feel comfortable talking about it. I mean, he would occasionally. He would talk about players he played against, but he didn't like talking about himself. I mean, he was just the ultimate professional. And sadly, I only got to work one full season with him in 08. And then he got sick with, at the time, it was, he had cancer in his throat. And we said it was a virus that he had in his vocal cords, which was affecting his voice, but he had had some radiation in cancerous growth. I think he might've had it removed too, but he had some radiation and his voice just wasn't the same. But he still did games 2009, 2010, and 2011. And he died in 2011, in May of 2011. I remember we were in Baltimore and my wife was with me, and she was there having a little girl's getaway with some of her girlfriends. And I got the call from Mike Swanson that Split had passed away, and his wife Lynn had let me know that, you know, it's probably coming. And I put the phone down and I hugged my wife, and I mean, I just cried like a baby in her shoulder. I mean, I was just, I was heartbroken because he was gone. I was selfishly sad because I wouldn't get to work with him anymore. And then I knew I'd never be able to give anything close to him that he gave to me. And then, I gave his eulogy at his service, you know, at his funeral, which was a tremendous honor. And I opened it by saying, me standing up here right now has more to say about Paul Splittorff than it has to say about me, because I'm still here because he is someone who welcomed me in the early years, you know? So, then Frank White came into a really tough situation to, you know, for Split. And Frank didn't have much television experience, but I tell you, every night, once or twice, he would say something that none of us had ever heard before about the strategy of the game or approach to the game. Or we'd go through a replay and he would say, now watch this. And what he should have done was that. And Kevin Shank, who was our producer at the time, I mean, there were so many times he would say in my ear after Frank something, he's like, wow, have you ever heard that before? And I'm just thinking, no. And so Frank will always be special to me because when I came to the Royals in 99, he was part of the coaching staff and, you know, Royals Hall of Famer, retired number, the whole thing. And he was great to me. I mean, there's so many people that just understood what I was going through and went out of their way to just make me feel welcome. And Frank was one of those. And then, you know, we got to work together. And then unfortunately the relationship soured between he and the Royals and was let go after the 2011 season. And that still breaks my heart, you know, that that hasn't been fully mended yet, because, you know, we see his statue all the time. We see his number up there all the time. And, you know, hopefully that's resolved sooner rather than later. But I feel like he was really on his way of being a good broadcaster. I don't think he had the coaching and the managing out of his system yet, though. I don't know if he was ready to be like that. And then Rex Hudler shows up in 2012, you know, having never played for the Royals, coming in after Frank White. I mean, you talk about challenging. I mean, as difficult as I can look back on how hard it was to follow Fred White, I mean, he followed Frank White. And I'm not going to surprise anybody with this answer, but I mean, he's just so different from any other time. I mean, there's very few broadcasters that are like him, and none, I think, in the history of Kansas City. I mean, so it was a jolt to everybody, you know, just the way that he broadcasted the games. And but I felt an obligation the first couple of years to do whatever I could to support him and give him whatever credibility that I was capable of giving him, and hoping that he would feel comfortable in Kansas City, not knowing if it was going to work out or not, but at least if it didn't, to feel like, you know, did I help him, right, like other people helped me when I was new to town? And, And we, you know, we've had our ups and downs in the booth. I mean, we're very different. I mean, there's, it would, if you were to list all the things that we have in common and all the things where we're different, you know, I mean, there's a lot more differences.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, David, because when, you know, before Split passed away on television, Split was the straight man and I was kind of the young sense of humor guy, right? On radio, Denny Matthews was the straight man and I was kind of the young sense of humor guy. And then like that, Rex Hudler comes to town and all of a sudden I'm the straight guy.
The straight man.
Woke up one, like, how did I become the straight guy? So we have different philosophies when it comes to, you know, broadcasting a game. And, you know, there have been times where I think, you know, in a game of tug of war, he's tried to drag me over to his side and I've tried to drag him over to my side. And I think, you know, what's just happened over time is that, you know, we've just really learned to respect how each of us sees the game and inform and entertain our audience. And I think we've done a good job of just meeting in the middle.
It's interesting. We could spend an entire hour just talking about some HUD-isms. And I'm not going to go down that path like Paulo Tripolo, and you know where that was going, right. and how you reacted to that. See, if my memory is correct, when you went through, when after he said that, you went, "We'll be back after these messages." You just let him dangle there. But I want to, like I said, we could go on and on about HUD, and it's really obvious that you guys have become really good friends. As different as you are, you guys work well together. Do you feel like that's developed?
Well, I hope so. If we go back to 1995, so back to my first year with the Twins, my dad was the hitting coach of the Oakland A's and Dick Stockton was doing A's games.
Oh, wow.
He would do he did 25 games a year just because he loved doing baseball. And the A's were in Minnesota and my dad said, "I want you to meet Dick Stockton." And we ended up playing golf at the University of Minnesota campus golf course. And then we went out to lunch afterwards. And I mean, it was just like, you know, I said, being around the players, I'm not, you know, awed by them, but I mean, there are some certain broadcasters that I was awed by. And Dick Stockton was one of them. I grew up in Los Angeles in the heyday of the Lakers, you know, and his voice was always the one, you know, for the NBA playoffs and the NBA championship. So, you know, I'm having lunch with Dick Stockton and I learned many things from him, but number one was, and I mean, I have followed this, like, you know, broadcasting gospel. He said, your number one job as a television play-by-play announcer, not different from radio, but as a television play-by-play announcer, your number one job is to make your analyst sound good, because television is made for the analyst. And if your analyst isn't very good, your broadcast isn't very good. And I thought, if Dick Stockton is telling me this, then, you know, certainly that should be my approach. And so I've always tried, even on radio, I mean, radio is more made for the play-by-play announcer, but
you know,
working with Denny Matthews the first years, and then on TV with Paul Splitorff and Frank White and Rex Hudler. I mean, I still to this day feel like my job before me sounding good and articulate and a storyteller and whatever, my analyst needs to sound good, because, you know, I go back in my TV days in Minnesota. I mean, I go back when, you know, we didn't have, you know, I'll use the screen right here, but, you know, maybe that little bug that's on the screen right there that says the score, how many outs, what inning you're in, the count, where the base runners are. You know, you turn on the TV and everything is right there and, you know, like, you're into it. Well, when I was doing TV in Minnesota back in the mid to late 90s, they didn't have that bug yet. And so even on television, the announcer had to do recaps. You know, it's 5-2 in the third inning. You know, outside, 3-2, you would do some radio things on TV. Well, now you turn on the TV and it's all right there for you. And so that bug is great for the fans, but it's taken a lot away from the play-by-play announcer, because a lot of times I can get caught saying what you can already see. So therefore, that even minimizes my role even more. So it has to be all about the analyst. So if you say that we work well together, then, you know, I'll take that as a compliment, because it is still my goal after all these years to make sure that, you know, my analyst or my partner, sounds good, that I work around their strengths.
It's one of my, and I've loved getting to know you, first of all, but listening to you and watching you, because, you know, especially when the Royals are on the road, I'm obviously not there covering. One of my all-time favorite Ryan Lefevre moments, though, was you with Fred White. And a lot of the credit, you know, no disrespect to you, but a lot of the credit goes to Fred, because you replaced him, and yet you and he became good friends.
Right.
I think you did the eulogy at his funeral as well. But my favorite Fred White, Ryan Lefevre moment, you probably remember where I'm going with this one. You guys were, Denny had started not traveling at every road trip, and you guys were together in Baltimore. Baltimore had a player named Jorge Julio. And it looks like George Julio for those of us, us WASPs, you know, but you guys start talking about Jorge Julio, and I think it was Fred who asked, or I don't remember who it was. One of you asked the other one, if Jorge Julio has a son and he names him after himself, would he be Jorge Julio Jr.? You guys laughed for three innings. You'd come back from commercial break and you're giggling like a couple of schoolgirls. Just talk about the relationship that you had with Fred White. And obviously, a lot of credit goes to Fred for not resenting you, but a lot of credit goes to you for allowing him not to resent you. Does that make sense?
Well, you said no offense to you, and there is no offense, because, I mean, it was Fred's character that put all of that in motion. And I go back to 1995. The Royals were in Minnesota for my first year with the Twins, and I believe they were the first team in for the Twins home opener. So that was the first visiting booth that I'd go listen to. And I told this story at his funeral that, you know, I kind of poked my head in the booth, and Don Free was to my left, and Denny was to my, I can still see it like it was yesterday. Denny was up front to my left. Fred was up front to my right, and the inning came to an end. And, you know, let's just pretend like I'm Fred White and I'm looking out at the game, and Denny is over here. The inning came to an end, and Fred just kind of swiveled his chair to say something to Don Free, and he saw me. And so this is the first time that I, you know, kind of spied on a broadcast. And he looked at me and he just kind of waved me and he said, come on in. You know, he had no idea who I was. And, you know, and he says, he goes, he saw my pass. He goes, oh, you work with the Twins? And I said, yeah, my name's Ryan Lefevre. And he said, oh, I know your dad. I used to interview him on the pregame show, and nice to meet you. I mean, that was the first time that a broadcaster whom I'd never met was, you know, very friendly to me. And John Woffen was doing games at that time. And later that night I ran into him and he said hello to me, and who knew that, you know, years later I'd be working for the Royals. But Fred from the very beginning was just very friendly toward me. In fact, I knew Fred better than I knew Denny. I knew Denny. Denny knew me before I took the Royals job. But I knew Fred much better. And when I accepted the job, I called Fred. I felt like I owed that to him. I really didn't know what I was going to say. I remember asking for his number, and, you know, it was an ugly situation in Kansas City. And I think, you know, the people were worried about, you know, what Fred might say to me or whatever. And I said, you know, I just want to give him a call. And he answered, and I waited a day or two because I wanted him to know that I had gotten the job. I didn't want to be the one to call him and tell him I got the job. And I just said, you know, from what I remember, is a long time ago now, but Fred, I don't know what to say other than, you know, I've accepted this job, and I just wanted to let you know that I respect everything that you've accomplished. I'm not going in there to show everybody how good I am. I mean, I realize I'm going to be sitting in your chair, and I hope if we see each other that we can continue to be friends or something like that. And he said, Ryan, I'll just tell you this. You have just gotten one of the greatest jobs in baseball, and I'm really happy for you. I think you're going to love it in Kansas City. And if there's anything I can do for you, you know, let me know. I was blown away. And he would go on the radio. And when he would go on, of course, whoever he was on with, and I don't blame him. I mean, a lot of those guys are my friends now, but they'd be like, oh my gosh, Fred, we miss you. And this, you know, I was 28-year-old kid from Minnesota and no ties to the area. And I, you know, I wish this kid would go away. We want you back on the air. And da, da, da. And time and time again, I would hear that Fred would say, I appreciate you saying that, but give him a chance. You know, just give him a chance. He's a nice person. He's good at what he does. Just give him a chance. And I mean, how do you attach value to that? You know, he ended up getting a job with Metro Sports. So he was there in spring training, my first spring training. And we spoke, not a lot, but we spoke. And then he'd be around the ballpark after that. And slowly but surely we would talk, and he was always very encouraging. But the breakthrough that you're referring to was my third year when Denny started cutting back. And somebody very smart came up with the idea, well, why don't we have Fred do the games that Denny misses? You know, the fans will love it. I don't think anybody was thinking about me, but the fans will just love it. Fred will be back on the air again. And I felt like, you know, in a normal pecking order, you know, you've got your number, you're on radio, you have your lead announcer, and the lead announcer always does at least the opening innings and the closing innings. I mean, it's just something that a lead announcer does. And then the number two announcer fills in, you know, the middle innings. Well, if Denny takes time off, then I should slide into the number one spot, and then Fred would be the number two spot. Well, that didn't sound right to me. I mean, this is Fred White we're talking about, you know. Yeah. Fred wouldn't have it. I was going to be the number one guy and he was going to be the number two guy. I mean, I even went to Split, and Split said, you know what? It might not be a bad idea if you let Fred be the number one guy. I mean, it just might be the right thing to do. Fred would not have it. I was going to be the number one guy. He was going to be the number two guy. And I think, David, when people heard Fred and me on the air talking baseball, laughing with one another, like the Jorge Julio thing, I think if I remember, Fred was saying, you know, it looks like George Julio, but it's actually Jorge Julio. And then he said, you know, if he had a son by the same name, he'd be Jorge Julio Jr. And then I think he opened up the media guide and he says, he does have a Jorge Julio Jr. You know, and I think that's when we started laughing, because he did have a son with the same name. But I mean, moments like that, that's when I think people started to accept me. I don't know if they embraced me at the time, but I always felt like people started to say, well, if Fred likes him,
yeah,
you know, maybe we can give him a chance. You know, if I get Fred's stamp of approval, you know, maybe the kid's all right. So, I mean, those, if you want to talk about turnaround years for me in Kansas City, it was when Fred and I did games together on the radio.
And I remember the next homestand after that road trip, I saw you, the old configuration of Kauffman Stadium. You were on a break. You went into the old media dining room, and you came out as I walked in, and I said, Jorge Julio Jr. And you started giggling again. I hope you didn't have to get right on the air, because you started laughing. It's still one of the funniest. I hope there's a broadcast or a copy of that somewhere.
And it's funny about our job. You know, you talk about taking yourself too seriously. You know, I mean, you know, we'll spend hours preparing for games and going over the stats and, you know, waiting for the right moment to tell a great story that ties into the game or whatever. So it might've been my first or second year with the Royals. It was, I mean, very early, and it was a bad game. And, Denny and I, you know, we even today, I mean, we don't do as many games together as we used to, but even today, I mean, I love working with Denny, and we understand each other. And when the game is not very entertaining, you know, he and I understand each other and play off of each other very well. And who knows what we're going to get into in a 9-1 game. And I don't remember what we were talking about with this tomato plants, but that's just the conversation that we got into. Well, the Royals, they come back and they tie the game, and we go into extra innings. And the way extra innings goes on radio is Denny does the ninth inning, I do the 10th, he does the 11th, I do the 12th. You know, that was the magic number in the playoffs. You know, I got to do the last out of the wild card game. I got to do, you know, the last out of the World Series in 2015, just because it was in the 12th inning. But that's how we would alternate. Well, we go to extra innings. So we go from tomato plants to this is a serious game here. And the Royals end up winning the game, I think, in walk-off fashion. I thought I had a pretty good call, you know, and I drive home and I turn the post-game show on, hoping I want to listen to the call. Was it any good, you know? And I listened to it. I was like, that was pretty good, you know? And I think Danny Klinkscale and Al Fitzmaurice are doing the post-game, and they may have even said, you know, that was a pretty good call. And so the next day, you know, I'm starting to feel like, hey, you know, maybe people think I'm okay. And I drive to the ballpark the next day, and I turn on talk radio, and they play the call again, and your Royals go for the sweep tonight. And all of a sudden I'm driving in, I'm thinking, all right, you know, I get to the ballpark, I get out of my car, and you know, this is hours before the game, but there's always some fans out there waiting for players to show up for an autograph. Excuse me. So I get out of my car and a couple fans come running my way, and they're like, hey, Ryan. And we're like, hey, we listened to you on the radio last night. And I'm thinking, here it comes. And they go, that conversation you and Denny had about tomato plants was hilarious. So back to Jorge Julio Jr. You don't remember anything from that game, David, but that's the funny thing about our business. Sometimes we can take ourselves too seriously, but it's those that's what people remember. They don't remember your call or the prediction that you made or the great insight you had on the game. They remember tomato plants and Jorge Julio Jr.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.